going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying. There is no running, there is no hiding. There's only fighting or dying. It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying. There is no running, there is no hiding. There's only fighting or dying.
It's Going Down is a digital community center from anarchist, anti-fascist, autonomous, anti-capitalist, and anti-colonial movements. Our mission is to provide an autonomous and resilient platform to publicize and promote revolutionary theory and action.
Go to itsgoingdown.org for daily updates. Check out our online store for ways to donate and rate and follow us on iTunes if you like this podcast. We're speaking once again with Autonomous Mutual Aid and tenant organizers across Texas about how anti-capitalist groups responded to the deep freeze that hit the state only several weeks ago. And once the storm did hit, many organizers found themselves both in the center of the storm and a growing story in the news media, which brought the eyes of the nation front and center on mutual aid projects in Texas.
Yeah, it was nuts. Like, Chrissy Teigen tweeted out, donate to @mutualaidhou, and we're like, oh, word? The spotlight was a lot, though, I'm not going to lie. So we're like 9 people in a group chat, you know what I mean? with like, and we all have like full-time jobs. One of us has a kid. You know, we're all dealing with our own fallout from the storm. And so we were suddenly facing like eyes all over the country, all over the world, and people not really understanding what kind of org we are. I think a lot of folks, especially because we're really, really good at the social media stuff, really good at the graphics, I think a lot of people assume that Mutual Aid Houston is like a massive nonprofit with a paid finance team. Was like, nah. We that's not the case at all. And so we face like a lot of pressure, like, why isn't this moving faster? Why aren't you doing more? And it's like, yo, we are in survival mode and doing the best we can. So it was really, really cool to get eyes on the need and to have so many people working to meet that need. But it was a lot of pressure to be sort of positioned as like a replacement for government aid because the government isn't doing their job. And for all of that to fall on us without people really understanding our capacity.
Yeah, I'd say for Austin, it was a blessing and a curse in our experience. Just to point again to that sort of like centralization that you mentioned. On the other hand, we were able to get out a lot of our sort of like political critique because of the relationship that we'd had with one of the groups that was getting a lot of information, was rebroadcasting a lot of our talking points and demands and spreading those around, which got a lot further than I think than we would have been able to get like without that help. On the other hand, the sort of ecology of organizing projects that played a role in this got flattened into what sort of like looks like a sort of like mutual aid like brand that like I know that the media like has really picked up like since COVID. You know, it's like almost like the next like kind of like Occupy, where you can just say that it's one thing when really it's like 12. That is just a limitation, I think, of the media, and it's on, I think, the bigger mutual aid projects that get a lot of that attention to kind of like spread the love and share and like point out that it's not just one crew that's doing all of it, and that like anybody can like get organized. And yeah, on the other hand, I think that mutual aid projects have to come with political critique and cannot be just allowed to become another arm of the state or the nonprofits that provide like resiliency for an oppressive society. that if these things are happening, like, absent of critique and criticism and alternative political projects, then, yeah, they're in danger of just, like, preserving the status quo and, like, making sure that we get from crisis to crisis without anything having changed.
It was kind of a mixed bag for us. You know, like I said earlier, there was initially a really small group of us who were, you know, members of Cooperation Denton. And, you know, as more attention, media attention was being brought to what was happening, you know, people were, you know, naturally going online and seeing what was, who was providing, you know, mutual aid, what kinds of things were going on, how, you know, people can help. And in that sense, I think that really helped us not only be able to mobilize more volunteers and support more people, it did bring, like, you know, people who are also good with social media to kind of put the word out. But, you know, with social media, there is that, like, the message can get really watered down. And I think, like, the few times that I was able to kind of get on, like, Instagram, for instance, and, like, see what was going on in the area, I'd see, like, posts of folks talking about mutual aid and, like, totally, like, kind of watering it down and not really speaking on the political nature of it. So that was definitely kind of a bummer to see. Well, you know, I was glad that they were, you know, pushing some of those efforts and trying to help. But ultimately, you know, we really want value keeping it political in that sense. I think with that, like, following that we had in Denton, you know, there were some, like, public officials that, you know, started kind of noticing what we were doing. When you know, the freeze first started, there weren't really, like, 24-hour warming centers. Like, they were doing, I think they'd close at, like, 7 or something like that, and then there were, like, no plans for what to do with people after 7 o'clock. They just kind of, I guess, expected everyone to go back out into the woods or wherever they were before. So we were able to kind of, you know, use that following to kind of pressure the city a little bit more. And eventually, you know, we did start seeing more 24-hour warming centers.
Yeah, and I think that we also started to kind of realize our ability to kind of agitate the system as well, like kind of what you were saying, in that, you know, we knew that we could, if enough people knew that there were folks without water or heat or whatever, then we would get that rectified pretty quickly. You know what I'm saying?
You know, I think, like, your question gets at the, it's contradictory. I feel like the media coverage kind of highlights, like, working class self-activity and resilience to sort of address its own needs in these crisis moments. However, at the same time, it really, at least for me, shows, like, how the state uses the working class's activity and resilience for its own benefit. Like, the working class is essentially doing the work of the state for it, you know, by carrying out this mutual aid work. It's less for the state to have to worry about. It's kind of like a form of austerity in a way. And then the state sort of, like, flips that narrative and tries to control it. And it also tries to control, like, the scope of how deep the work actually goes, you know? So, for example, like, Hurricane Harvey, we had in Houston this saying, like, Houston strong, right? And what Houston strong sort of meant was that while it kind of highlighted the working class's ability to take care of itself, it also sort of meant that, like, in terms of, like, a capitalist narrative that, like, you know, us Texans, we're resilient, we're strong-willed, we're kind of pick yourself up by your bootstraps, right? And we kind of take care of our own in that way compared to, like, other people who don't. So it's really contradictory in nature, you know?
All right, well, let's just going forward, let's talk specifically about the mutual aid projects themselves. And I know some people here were involved in other things too. So, you know, whatever you want to talk about in terms of your own activity. But let's talk about the scope, the size, and just how they were received on the ground at the time when you started to put these things into practice.
So another really difficult thing about organizing in Houston is it's such a sprawling city. I've spoken about this with organizers from smaller areas, still urban areas, but just smaller, more cohesive cities. So unfortunately, something that people need to realize about mutual aid is that it's usually pockets of very few people doing a whole lot of work. And that is the reality of every mutual aid grassroots organization that I know. And so unfortunately, we don't have the sheer numbers to spread out all over the city. And so what we were doing, and we were working with other amazing orgs like the Houseless Organizing Coalition and Say Her Name HTX. We had a couple of distribution centers set up. We tried to switch locations every day, where we just ask people, you know, come bring every bit of extra supplies you have and drop it off at this location and stay to help distribute if you can. So we were able to do that for several days, which was really, really awesome. And we also continued coordinating like drivers to actually drop off supplies at individual people's homes if they needed it, especially like elderly folks, disabled folks. And then in terms of the financial solidarity, like our GoFundMe, gosh, how raise a couple hundred thousand-ish, I want to say, in our GoFundMe. I could be making that up. Yeah, we ended up raising about 300,000 in our GoFundMe, and the Venmo and Cash App donations kept pouring in. And so we are still in the process of figuring out how to distribute all of this. But what we did immediately was we created an immediate aid request form. It was just a Google form for folks who like just need to go buy groceries. You know what I mean? And so we distributed $100. So I just kind of sat down for like 14 hours at a time for a few days, and was Venmoing people $100. And I think we ended up reaching about 520 Houstonians. So we distributed about $200,000. Directly into Houstonians' pockets. And right now we are waiting to like iron out some kinks on the Cash App front so that we can distribute some more. And then we will be pivoting that financial redistribution to like longer term needs in the wake of like, you know, pipes bursting, floors flooding, ceilings crumbling, that sort of thing.
Well, I wanted to jump off of a bit about how it was the mutual aid projects were received. Something I noticed this time that's interesting is we've seen a little bit more acknowledgement from the state of the mutual aid, at least locally. The local government has sometimes in limited ways worked with mutual aid, especially with some of the groups that got the most media attention. The Austin Mutual Aid Group, which is the one that's gotten a lot of media attention, has been able to stage out of basically our local convention center or coliseum. There's also been some collaboration with the local firefighters association directly with mutual aid groups providing water. And that's been interesting. There have been some cases, though, where, you know, where one department in the city will say, yes, we will work with you. You can access these resources, you know, and then other mutual aid group or then other departments in the city will say, wait, no, you can't just give that away to people. And at that point is when mutual aid groups have to be flexible and show that they can still bite the hand that feeds them and say, wait, we're going to take resources for the people and you can help us or not. And at that point, in some cases, the city has, you know, allowed, for example, people to access water through certain channels that they were trying to block. So I think it's been kind of this interesting push-pull in some cases, where obviously the state still is very leery, of course, of working with us unless they can, you know, co-opt us. But there have been cases where there's been this kind of interesting, not quite collaboration, but uneasy truce, and maybe an acknowledgement on the part of the state that we're doing a better job than them because they've tapped us to help.
Yeah, I guess I would just reiterate that. Because a lot of our mutual aid stuff has been ongoing since the pandemic, and based on relationships going before that, we were you know, pretty well received in the camps. That like, yeah, there were already like lots of relationships of trust that had been built. I think more broadly, it was really interesting to sort of go through another like giant crisis moment that I think brought a lot of empathy, even though there's a lot of haters out there, as Kit mentioned. The fact that the mutual aid funds, even when they were like just supposed to be used for hotels, went huge, got huge amounts of money. And I guess, as I said before, like money is complicated and isn't everything, and like needs, you know, political critique to go along with the resources and that organizing. People's focus was like attuned in that way, I think, like leads me to think that there's a lot of possibility for sympathetic audiences to the political critiques and the political organization that we're attempting.
It has been wild for just these really established publications to be like, if you want to help Texans, donate to this org. And it's like, wow, that is wild that we are one of the only answers right now. Like, I think like a school district started referring parents to us, and it was like, it was nuts.
Well, like I said, some of these organizations go back, you know, to the Ferguson days, Mike Brown Rebellion era. One of the oldest ones here would be BLMHTX. They come out of the Ferguson era, and they've been doing work since then. So what is that? 7 years now. And they are kind of partnered up with a group called West Street Recovery, which came out of Hurricane Harvey. And they have different areas that they focus on in the city, mainly in Black neighborhoods. So on the north side and some in the south side. And, you know, during Harvey, West Street Recovery was doing like mucking work, getting people out, getting different skilled trades people out to make repairs, providing all sorts of necessities for people in terms of like cleaning products so that way mold wouldn't grow anymore, water, food, blankets, clothing, you name it. They were out there kind of giving these things away. And that work, I'm sure, continued during this recent ice storm. Now, after George Floyd, the two of the newest organizations would be Say Her Name HTX and the Houseless Organizing Coalition. And if I'm not mistaken, a lot of those new organizers come out of that moment there. And they're like, you know, mutual aid groups. The Houseless Organizing Coalition focuses on the houseless population here in Houston. And from what I can tell, they're received, you know, pretty warmly on the ground. Some of them have like roots going back to these different neighborhoods for the past, like I said, 7 years. So their sizes vary. Probably some of the bigger ones are maybe the older organizations like BLMHTX and West Street Recovery. And then I think the newer ones like Say Her Name and Houseless Organizing Committee or HOC are maybe not as big, but still have a decent size. And they're out there hustling, you know, they're grinding, trying to get people what they need.
One of us found on the local, one of the local King haters, Matt McCowiak, who runs the Travis County Republican Party here, who's behind a new ordinance proposal that will ban camping and panhandling and reinstate no sit, no lie ordinances like all through town. He had posted to his personal Facebook account that he was trying to book a flight to Miami and wanted to split the costs on this private jet and put his personal cell phone number out there. So got some screenshots of that and spread that around. And ultimately, I believe he's a state senator, Lloyd Doggett, of all people, reposted it. Sort of a petty partisan shot or whatever. But, you know, whatever. Dude got his phone rung up a whole bunch. But I think that they were really just like kind of like out for themselves in this moment in a big way that I think we saw on like a lot of levels.
I feel generally, you know, among the people that we're around directly in community with, we're pretty well received. People definitely saw like all of the ways in which the state and public officials failed us and, you know, really showed up for their community. And we're we got a lot of, you know, different people asking how they can help, what they can do. We did have a similar situation where, you know, when we were putting out like our GoFundMe and our Venmo and Cash App and stuff like that, where there was some public officials like passive aggressively posting on their pages, like, donate to safe organizations, like, you know, some of the nonprofits here in the area. So there was definitely some feelings on their end towards us.
Yeah, we got fully doxxed by the city of Aledo because we were trying to advocate. We got the call to action for the 200 elementary school kids who hadn't had water. And so we did a call to action and we were like, look, this is the price we got. This is how much money we're going to need to rectify this situation. And the city of Aledo actually did a Facebook post that they deleted and said that there were no kids in the city of Aledo who needed help, and called us scammers and called another affiliated organization with us, which is the Funky Town Fridge, which provides food security in Fort Worth and also has like 10,000 followers. Okay. And they called us scammers publicly and tried to discredit our organizations. And so it's just kind of like, yeah, that fueled us just to go out and hand out hundreds in their communities. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, we had there was a lot of trying to co-opting. It's like, well, look what we did here. And that's fine. It's whatever. We're not interested in getting into the petty things with some of these groups and stuff like that, even though they seem to be very interested in getting into it with us. Denton's own mayor literally posted from his personal Facebook account, congratulations, mayor. And then from his public Facebook account, thank you. I mean, it was such a disconnect. It was so weird watching like some of the responses go down in real time. It was like, it was just very disconnected. As far as like from, you know, other groups or, you know, anything like, well, there's those anti-paw folk or anything like that. I noticed that, you know, surely in communities, you know, the fascists are going to do what they're going to do, and racists and Scottishness and stuff like that are going to do what they're going to do. But, you know, the average person is going to toss away partisan politics real quick when they're freezing or when they don't have food or they don't have water. And these are things that we can, you know, that you can look at, and, you know, it's community. You know, we're not naturally, you know, throughout history, we've took care of each other. You know, it's the state and capitalism that's, and really all in all, the patriarchy that's divided us so much.
I guess I also just real quick want to mention that another project that emerged during the freeze, the 401 Orisha Land Establishment and Occupation in East Austin, recently started to receive a lot of right-wing attention. There was an article posted about them in Law Enforcement Today magazine, and they were issued a notice to vacate the park today, and I believe that that's based on the right-wing attention that they got in the week since the freeze.
You're listening to It's Going Down, part of the Channel Zero Anarchist Podcast Network. If you like this show and you want to support our work, please go to itsgoingdown.org/shop. Again, that's itsgoingdown.org/shop, and sign up to become a monthly supporter or give us a one-time donation through the site or on Bitcoin. Thanks a lot for listening. Let's get right back to it. There's been a lot of collective organizing and direct action that's been happening in response to the deep freeze. So let's talk about that. I know some groups aren't on here, like 401, but for those that are, let's talk about what kind of organizing you've been doing.
This is such an interesting question because I think that's so much of... first of all, I love 401. They're so cool. But I think that's so much of like truly radical community care gets like undertaken by people who aren't like in an official org, right? Like people, it's just like Houstonians being in community with each other. And those are the ones, that don't have Twitter accounts and that don't get news coverage. And so I think there's a lot more, solidarity, and mutual aid work being done behind the scenes. But in answer to your question, like when I think of like just truly amazing, wonderful solidarity work, I think of the House's Organizing Coalition. They just work like relentlessly, to dismantle oppressive systems, implemented by the state. They work relentlessly in solidarity with houseless comrades in Houston. They truly embody a community. I have so much admiration for them. And I think that more people in different cities all over should look to their work and start their own coalitions in that way. I think that there is a little bit of hesitation when it comes to starting this kind of work. It's like, ooh, like, do I have to start an org and like a Twitter account and blah, blah, blah. And it's like, no. I think that the most radical work gets done when you just decide to not be an individual alone and decide to actually decenter the self and work with the community.
I would just like to start out with it by saying, you know, I want to, you know, a big thank you to like all the groups, the ones here doing what they do, the boots on the ground here in Texas. As far as North Texas goes, we have, you know, the Rural Resiliency is here, and Feed the Funk in Fort Worth did a lot of work. Dallas Stops Evictions did a lot of work. DFW Mutual Aid, they raised $197,000 to do work. I mean, they're putting in a hell of a lot of work there. So, you know, some big props to all of them, of course.
Some of our efforts, like as Cooperation Denton, we're not like necessarily always mutual aid. We're really more like in the Bookchin vein. So social ecology, libertarian municipalism. Most of, you know, our long-term projects are to really set up what are called neighborhood pods. And in short, what those are like, kind of grown out of mutual aid networks, you know, and have really taken off in the midst of the pandemic. And the goal is to really build more community and self-reliance, especially in these times, because they can really provide a solution to some of these problems that we're seeing. They kind of encourage us more to turn to the people around us and discuss how we can take care of each other and rely less on these big institutions. You know, and it could start off as like neighborhood gardens or neighbors just sharing veggies. Long term, what we're really trying to build is like people getting together and building real dual power, so that we don't have to outsource these problems to institutions, police, courts. The goal is to make the state and the broader economy and all institutions that we and our neighbors have little to no say over, obsolete in our lives. Yes, community gardens and all of those things are really great, but we really want to shift more towards becoming political and self-organizing, where people can meet their own needs. And, you know, when we say political here, we're really referring to like people managing the community by means of face-to-face, direct community conversation and formulating of what works for us. Our hope is by establishing these kinds of things before, like tenant-owned, like housing places, ways that we have already collectively organized to start, like already meet each other's needs. Like these are things that can help prepare for what's to come, because I don't think this is going to be it. There's going to be more. So there is definitely that need to start connecting with the people around you to mitigate like the impact.
I guess a couple things. It's to me, one of the interesting parts of what 401 is doing is they published a piece on their social media that was describing what they were doing as not mutual aid. And I think that's a really interesting attitude and position in this moment, where they're based on creating moments that destabilize the the white supremacist like power structure like as it is. And I think it's I think it's really crucial to look at these moments both like from the lens of survival, but also through that lens of how can we actually like shake that up that is that's keeping everybody down and keeping us in a well-ordered society that's brutal to so many people. Another thing that Paiasso wanted to mention that I think works really well right here with what y'all are talking about from Denton is that autonomous organizing and action really needs to base itself in strategy and long-term sustainability versus urgency and short-term reactive work. That that we certainly need to have like space to be able to like move quickly, but that like the sort of like long-term vision and longer-term commitments and longer-term principle building allow for the room to like hustle really hard, point beyond the sort of like immediacy of the crisis to, you know, the following week where, you know, the sky's blue here, but like we're finding people in camps who didn't make it. You mentioned a march that was held. We held a march the Sunday after the freeze ended, a memorial, and then a march that was honoring a woman who died in an encampment that's run by the state of Texas, like out very far on the east side of town, in a abandoned like industrial lot that the state owns. Like they just like shoved like hundreds of people over there, and one woman passed away during the freeze. So, and then connected that to our demands to keep people in the hotels, to keep banging on the hotels, that they've got all this empty space that they're just warehousing for someday when you know the world opens up 100% like Governor Abbott wants, or when they can like flip that to a different sort of real estate developer and make a bunch of money off of it. But they're just sitting on like while hundreds of thousands of people are sleeping out on the streets. Yeah, I think that there is a need to really like hone our principles and let our principles lead, and that they can point to all sorts of different like actions to take like in this moment and in these moments where the state is just scrambling to like make sure that like the lights are on or that like everybody's like kind of again paying attention to like what the mayor is saying, even though like a week ago he was like totally silent, you know, trying to like regain that sort of legitimacy.
So this campaign at Villas del Paseo kind of dropped in our lap. We were referred to these tenants by another group, and we were put in touch with tenants there. As you can imagine, the conditions are like horrendous, and the tenants themselves have sort of been piecing things together for us, kind of laying out like why things are the way they are. Okay. So at this complex, what happened was, the main water valve coming in from the city is working fine. So that one can turn off and turn on. You can cut the water supply off and on at will. However, the shut off valves to each individual building are in various states of functionality. So some are broken, some work okay, and the ones that are broken, you know, you can't turn the main valve off unless you're able to turn that water shutoff valve off as well, because if you leave it running, then that whole building is going to flood, and that's exactly what happened. They don't have any water because these individual water shutoff valves to certain buildings are broken, and so they can't give everyone water because they're going to flood a number of buildings in the complex. And the tenants kind of made us aware of the situation through their own experience and just time at the complex, right? And when organizers hit the ground there, they were just ready to go. Like they were off, you know, they immediately were like, we got to hit people where it hurts. We need to like withhold the one thing that we have control of, which is like our ability to pay rent. And people there sort of were like, okay, cool. And they from there hit the ground running. And it's been just like a huge attempt on our part to keep up with tenants there and their militancy and energy, you know. And I'm sure that we know for a fact that these same conditions are happening at various complexes around Houston. We're getting calls and emails from tenants all the time being like, hey, we have this going on here. What can we do here? What can we do there to address our situation? What we're trying to think through right now as a union is how do we really start to give the tenants the tools they need to carry these things out on their own and begin organizing, even if we can't necessarily get people on the ground there immediately. And so we're thinking of different things to do to address that. One thing that one of our organizers threw out is we need to maybe hold like a Zoom call for tenants where they can just join in and we can do presentations, trainings for them to help them get their own organizing off the ground. And this campaign now is providing us a lot of insight on how exactly to frame that, how to do that, because we're having to develop so many things on the go with tenants, all sorts of infrastructure, right? From communications, to legal committees, mutual aid distribution. Like there's so many moving parts to it. It's definitely a multiracial struggle. So Southwest Houston is the most densely populated area of the city. And it's also the most international part of Houston. So in this complex alone, we have tenants from all over Latin America. We have tenants from Nigeria, India, you know, Arab speaking countries, you name it. Like it's just a melting pot out there. The main crux of the tenants there, a large portion of them are Latino and Spanish speaking. We have a language justice committee that's been working their ass off to, you know, keep up with translations and interpreting all that stuff.
If people wanted to discuss kind of the shift from when the storms had passed and then the terrain kind of changed and that a lot of people were left in this new situation where they either had to boil water or they weren't able to access water or their pipes had burst and they were dealing with that. And there was kind of this whole new normal that had been created post-storm. And I know a lot of people across Texas are still dealing with that. Maybe they might have the power back on, but they're not able to actually get drinking water. If you can just kind of talk about that new reality.
The transition was really one of like, from frantic helplessness to, okay, so now we have more long-term problems to try and figure out how to survive through. It is so mammoth a mountain to be looking at right now. Because I've seen like a big wave of like legal information being disseminated. It's like, hey, y'all legally can't be evicted because of XYZ. Like, please like reach out to us and we can help you navigate the your landlords are throwing at you. Hey, like I know a plumber who's willing to do X, Y, and Z. Like it's really shifted from just like, oh my God, we are all going to die right now to like, okay, things were bad before the storm and now they're worse. Let's just try and deal with one problem at a time. Let's get this wall fixed. Let's get this family fed. So it's the answer sucks, right? The answer sucks because the answer is like, it's just continuing to be bad. People are just continuing to figure out how to keep each other alive with very little outside help. And when I say outside, I mean like institutional help. I would just say like the immediate threat of death is perhaps just not hanging quite as low. But right now it's a lot of the same thing. It's a lot of just the same survival mechanisms. And if anything, it will just get less national attention now because the storm has passed. And so, Houstonians are just going to keep gritting their teeth and pushing through all the problems.
Yeah. Okay. So I think a lot of our participants aren't necessarily new to like the water boil game, because a lot of them are on privatized water sources consistently, and that they have like privatized well water, and somebody will buy the well and then change the provisions of their water source or whatever. Anyways, so they are not necessarily new to like having, it's not new to them that they have to boil their water or that they can't shower for a few weeks because the water is unsafe because the system has been contaminated. But definitely it has added a sense of urgency because to the people who are attempting to repair or whatever, or to the companies who own the water source, because we're like, you know, yo, why the hell did these people have not have water for the last 14 days or whatever? You know what I'm saying?
I'll say here in Austin, it was a real shock to the system for a lot of people. A lot of people were not prepared for that. They didn't have a lot of drinking water on hand. Some of them, you know, the boil water notice came when they still didn't have power, which really put them in a bind if they didn't have the ability to turn on their range, if they didn't happen to have a gas range. And it just kind of felt like an additional trauma on top of the loss of water. Or power, rather, before that had gone on so long for so many people. I do want to shout out that this was a moment where people from outside the state were able to really help. I think during disaster, sometimes we see people come in from outside of an area and they don't necessarily listen to what's needed. But in this case, there was a need to actually truck water in from outside the state because the demand was so strong. And a few groups arrived in Austin and other parts of Texas, I know, with water from outside. There was the Capitol Hill Outreach Medics from Denver and at least one other group I don't unfortunately know the name of that brought in water, and they also brought plumbing supplies, which is something that I think a lot of people wouldn't have thought of, but they were very listening. They were listening, they got in touch with locals, and they really made a good connection to find out what we really needed here. And I think that's something I want to highlight. The other side of it, though, is that, of course, it's been a struggle to keep the attention on Texas. As the weather warms up, I think it's easy for people to assume that things are okay here. But we've had to kind of fight in that attention economy as people want to move on to the next crisis and the next trending topic, that really we're still here. The recovery is going to be an ongoing process here. And there's people who don't even have water still, like you said, at their apartments. So that's been kind of the next stage of the struggle.
I would say from Denton, as far as like how the, you know, things have changed, it's like, you know, the more affluent neighborhoods have sort of realized what it's like to live as, you know, some of their poor neighbors have. You know, we all know about the Flint situation and how that went down, you know, with the poor neighborhoods. And, of course, Houston, when it flooded a couple years back after the hurricane. You know, most of the places that were hit hard with, you know, water restrictions and stuff like that were poor neighborhoods or, you know, neighborhoods of color. You know, that's the way it is all over the country. You know, that's that whole big deal about, you know, the social ecology. You know, it always seems that, you know, poor neighborhoods are always around the factories belching out the toxic fumes. They're always the ones that have to deal with, you know, power outages when you shouldn't expect power outages, or with, you know, water where they're not safe. They're not sure if it's safe to, you know, give to their children. It's nice to be able to see that, you know, I hate to be anybody went through this, but, you know, we all have to realize, and people sometimes have to be shown to realize that it's not all, the system doesn't provide all these wonderful things for you on a regular basis. They might provide it for you, but they don't provide it for, you know, more disadvantaged neighborhoods or, you know, neighborhoods that are, you know, black or brown. Or indigenous, you know, these neighborhoods are not always provided these things, and more than likely not, they're always put in the crosshairs the worst conditions of these types of things. You know, that's one of the big things that did change. As far as an organization, what changed for us, you know, we're definitely looking at, you know, a much more two-pronged approach. You know, we took a lot of, you know, ideas from, you know, organizations here in the country, you know, Cooperation Jackson, Carbondale Springs, Symbiosis and stuff like that. You know, a lot of our, you know, or organizing as far as trying to create a decentralized structure and, you know, a horizontal structure, you know, come from places like, you know, Rojava and Chiapas. So, we created a mutual aid council to deal specifically with things happening in the now to, you know, make sure. And like was stated just a second ago, I think people think that, oh, it's, you know, it's warm now. It's, you know, 70, 80 degrees here, you know, at least in North Texas. You know, everything is fine. Everything is dandy and it's great and wonderful and we're all back to normal. And it's just really not the case. So there's still a lot of stuff to deal with on the ground, you know, with the water situation and just, you know, people being out of work, you know, not being able to work for the whole week. And then their landlord is still demanding, you know, the rent money to come up. So there's still a lot of work. You know, that's the one thing I would say to anybody listening outside of Texas, there is still a lot of work. Just because it's warmer don't mean it's better.
When I think about the way that the terrain has changed, I'm thinking also a lot about how people are kind of like still holding a lot of this like emotionally, especially, you know, like y'all were saying, like it's not all over yet. So these crises like aren't past, but especially after that first week where like people were like hustling so hard and like trying to support others while like, you know, not able to get out of their apartment complex, like on their own or they didn't have water at their house. They were still out that like, there's just all this like compounding, trauma and stress that people have been just sitting in for weeks, if not like months and months now. And that like, while there was a lot of possible, where there was a lot of possibility in that moment, there's also a lot of ways that we like internalize a lot of, the really stressful stuff that's happening to us. And, just trying to encourage people to take care of each other and be careful with each other and, to, you know, take a breath or take a moment to like take some time out if they haven't gotten that in weeks. For others of us, you know, like once the freeze stopped, we had to go back to work. So then figuring out how to like stay like connected to the people who are still in crisis, even though like the capitalist economy is like dragging us back in. Yeah, a lot of those things, like just within the relationships, I think have needed a lot of tending, especially as stuff has sort of slowed down a little bit. And it's been a challenge to tend those things and also like keep momentum up and keep political pressure up. And, you know, that just may be something that limits our capacity in ways that are sad and disappointing.
The boil water, mandate ended. It's probably been about a little over a week now. So there's some sort of like seeming normality like taking place right now, but people are still like super desperate. Like, you know, water pipes have burst like in numerous people's homes. Supplies are short in hardware stores. People are really leaning on each other to like figure out how to start making repairs on their own or mitigate damage. In terms of the housing stock, like there are unresolved problems like from Harvey and previous floods here. So this exacerbated those conditions as well. So I think overall, it's just like a really extreme case of like just desperation. People are desperate, to get their issues resolved, and they're open, super open to any kind of way to do that, right? And I think this is where like the rent strike kind of came in and their willingness to just go from 0 to 100 right off the bat.
You know, one big story while this was going on was, of course, Ted Cruz attempting to go on vacation in Cancun. I'm just curious, you know, did this act and kind of the media spectacle around it, along with, you know, politicians, like there was that one mayor that posted on Facebook saying like only the strong will survive and that people should stop asking the government for handouts because it's socialism and all this stuff. Do you feel that this crisis has created a shift in the broader population in terms of how they see the ruling class or the state itself?
You know, it's so hard to say, right? Because it's like on one level, like none of this is surprising. Right. Like none of this is surprising at all. Cruz has been he has never cared. And so I think that most of the people who recognize what he did as appalling were not particularly thrilled with him to begin with. For those who were fans of Ted Cruz, I don't know that this was enough to push them over the edge. Maybe some more, maybe this had a profound effect on like maybe some like the more moderate folks, you know what I mean? Because I do think this was like a particularly ill-timed and singularly gross act of evil that clearly even he couldn't escape backlash for. So I honestly don't know the answer to that. I would hope, like, I didn't really see, there was already so much rage toward elected officials when the storm hit and everything got devastated. It deepened the rage for sure, but I don't know if I would like say that was like a radical shift.
Yeah, I think, you know, unfortunately it's still sort of like, you know, trying to combat like going back to normal times, but I think there was a lot of anger and frustration and a desire to break with this that, you know, unfortunately is sort of getting like turned into like, bah, Republicans bad, you know, mismanagement of this, mismanagement of that. But I think that there's like an undercurrent where people have had a lot of experience with who may not have had it before. Some people have had it, and it's just a deeper experience of being, you know, shut out by the system. But yeah, there's a lot more people who have that on their minds now for maybe the second time in a year, you know.
I think for as far as for cooperation is concerned, I think there might be some change. You still see quite a bit of support for the system, and you know, a lot of hoorah and stuff like that, you know, for things that are done, and you know, or you know, on the neoliberal side, you know, being like, well, you know, those Republicans, we've got to change it all, you know, while you know at the same time ignoring that what got us through wasn't any political party at all. It was our community, it was our neighbors, it was the people next door to us that got everybody through. You know, I can say for Cooperation Denton that if it was just the eight of us through this entire event, we might have made it. But, you know, there would have been repercussions as far as, you know, just burnout and stuff like that. And, you know, our neighbors and our community really came through, you know, on that aspect. So, you know, I'm hoping that, you know, between that and COVID, because, you know, we saw a lot of the same type of things when COVID first started, you know, people started realizing that, you know, we got us, you know, the system's not going to help us. We have to help each other.
I've been seeing a lot of anger just in the last couple of days as our governor has suddenly and abruptly ended our mask mandate in the state. And a lot of that anger feels focused on the idea that he's making us less safe from the pandemic as a way to distract from his mishandling of the Texas freeze. And not only do I think there's truth in that, I think that shows there's still this buried or under the surface anger, even as there is a push to quote unquote return to normal, the normal of the pandemic. There's still this anger against the governor, against the government. And I think even though a lot of it is focused at the Republican establishment in our state, I do think as our comrades are saying from all around the state right now, there is this window of opportunity where people are more aware of what mutual aid made possible, and maybe we can use this moment to create that political critique.
I'd agree. You know, one of our main purposes is dual power, you know, and hopefully that critique leads to that, you know, as far as like the new mandate on masks and stuff like that. You know, there was a lot of kickback as well from even, you know, the further alt-right feeding on the individualism of Texas and this whole ideal that, you know, well, they're telling us what to do. They're telling us what to do. So, I mean, it's just, it's the waters right now are real muddied in a lot of the political groups. But I do agree that this is definitely a time to, you know, the mutual aid to focus on the community building. You know, I have all the faith in the world that, you know, the groups here and this in this meeting and the groups everywhere else are going to do that. Because, you know, I know some of your groups, I know some people in some of y'all's groups, and a good bunch of folks, so.
I'd probably say there's a little more heightened sense, you know, of the kind of hypocrisy that exists out there amongst politicians and other ruling class members. You know, they see this going to Cancun while we're all here, like, you know, dying and freezing off. And it's convenient for him to cross the border whenever he wants to. So, you know, we've seen this highlighted in a tons of memes. Like, there's just tons of memes floating out there here in Texas and everywhere about Ted Cruz. And I think it reflects that kind of heightened sense of, like I said, hypocrisy, but also just like straight up racism, you know. Something similar happened during Harvey with the preacher Joel Osteen. He said his church was flooded and you couldn't get in. And then people kind of went out there, took pics, and they were like, yo, what's up? Like, they ain't flooded, you know, what it do? You gonna let us in or what? And so, you know, since that, people really, his popularity and his credibility has taken a serious hit in the city. He hasn't really, I would say, recovered from that. And I think it might be hard for Cruz to do the same thing. And it just, like I said, it makes clear, like, the hypocrisy out there.
I think one thing to highlight here, there's been all this attention on, you know, Ted Cruz and on the governor and the failures there. But I think it's also been a failure of the, you know, as people have said, of the Democrats. And one thing I noticed on social media was how many sort of center left big people with accounts, platforms, were just eager to throw Texas under the bus and say, well, this is what they get for voting Republican. And I think that just really is a tactic to overlook how universal these problems really are, that there are people that are suffering everywhere, especially under this pandemic. And I think that is another opportunity. It shows that really, like, you know, the working class can get organized, and I think we can use the willingness of some of these people outside, you know, just the willingness of powerful people across the political spectrum to throw us under the bus the minute it's politically expedient for us, to say, well, that's what they get for being in the wrong place at the wrong time and the wrong people. I think that that's an opportunity to organize, because it just shows how little they care about us.
From being in the position of being in an org that is built to combat the, like, ongoing crisis of homelessness and state oppression of unhoused and landless people, now had to respond and build organization to address two giant catastrophes. And that has been something that I would not have imagined was in our future, although it's not, I'm not shocked. I think that if we're staying in the sort of, like, you know, obviously, like, do what you got to do to survive, kind of hustle to survive, kind of move really quick, make fast decisions and all that. But keep your eyes on the prize, you know what type of world you're striving for, and use the momentum to build your capacity to build out more of the world that you want to see, and to fight off those who would keep you from having that power. If all we are is FEMA, then we're just offering resiliency to already messed up and historically, like, awful system.
Seems like what happened in Texas is a sign of things to come for many of us. And with this in mind, I'm curious, you know, in your minds, what are some of the key takeaways from the situation that you feel other people can learn from and incorporate into their own organizing or struggles?
First of all, yes, like 100% organize within your communities. There are so many amazing mutual aid, like, handbooks and zines, and there's so much literature and advice out there on how to get started. Like, solidarity looks like everything from, like, getting groceries for your elderly neighbor to, like, housing unhoused folks. You know, like, there's so many parts of this work. And my biggest advice would be to, like, just do everything you can to not do this alone. I think there's a lot of mistrust in organizing spaces, especially in a city like Houston. Houston is a uniquely, I think, mistrustful city. But I really can't stress enough, like, how powerful it is to have coalitions of people doing the work and of not just staying online. I think there's digital organizing is so important. It's so crucial, but that's not where all the work is. And you miss so many marginalized populations, by staying online. My advice to people would be to get on the ground as much as possible and start building trust with the most marginalized members of your community and like actually doing the work there and really thinking of it as an ongoing process of building. It's like if you've got like 5 people working on houseless outreach and 5 people working on like community fridges, like meet up regularly, you know, have open forums and like invite community members in and like get their input. Just I think connecting community members together is really, really powerful. And so when there are huge institutional failures like this with the Great Freeze, there is a network in place of support and solidarity that no government institution will ever provide.
One challenge in Texas is just how big it is. There were a couple of times where I wanted to reach out to somebody in another area because I'd heard from somebody that was in trouble, and it's just hard to create connections across the state. That was one of the limitations we had, is trying to create a multi-city network is something that I don't think we have here yet that is challenging but might still present some benefits if we could create it. There were people doing such good work all over, and I wonder if there's ways we can draw that together, especially, you know, for those of us who are in Austin who are more able to advocate directly at the seats of political power, whether that, you know, provides opportunities for people that are further out that could work with us. I don't know. I'm just kind of speculating out loud here on that. I think, you know, the more organizing that you can create in advance, between organizations, between cities, between communities, and then, of course, also drilling down to the local level, the more you can organize neighborhoods, which it sounds like some people on this discussion are doing an amazing job of. You know, just the time to organize is always now.
Yeah, I think one major limitation and obstacle is, trying to navigate, like, okay, so we went through a really hectic time. We got a lot done. There were multiple organizations involved. Sometimes like there's like wrong done along the way. And, you know, how do you create like accountability, like between groups and with people that you're organizing with in ways that leave us stronger at the end of the day, even if you do need to draw lines. Another thing is, again, the sort of like emotional like toll that everybody is carrying, and doing planning that's like inspiring and where expectations and asks are like clearly communicated so that people know what they're committing to, and then giving people the opportunity to like step back and sit down and like heal for a minute, while also like continuing to like carry the torch of the struggle like forward, are all really it's just sort of hard to manage. Oh, that and the sort of like overwhelming power of the NGOs once they finally get their noses in it, you know, coming in with a lot of cred immediately, even though they were nowhere on the ground when the trouble hit.
So, and this is unique to this freeze, right? It's just like the unpreparedness of it all. I think we were unprepared for just like the gravity and devastation of the storm. We as an org were certainly not expecting how many eyes would turn to Texas when it ended up being cool. But, you know, now we've developed some systems to handle this amount of financial solidarity in the future. But I think like the major limiting factor, and I'm sure this isn't only true of Houston, but especially in a city as sprawling and fragmented as Houston, is like there are still so many populations and areas that are missed. Like there are just still so many underserved people in need. And I think really taking the time in times of like non-weather crises to develop plans on how to have a more preventative approach to these calamities could be really helpful. And this is not like an accusatory thing toward ourselves or anyone else. Like, honest to God, we shouldn't have to be dealing with this, right? Like, it should not be a group of 20-somethings in a group chat trying to figure out how to not, like, have people die. But yeah, I would say, like, number one thing is, like, true accessibility, reaching the most vulnerable and marginalized populations, institutionally cut off from access. And, you know, just learning and showing grace to ourselves, because this work can be very heavy and the burnout can be very real, and like the stakes are high all the time. And so going into it with a very gracious and like steady and methodical and preventative mindset could be helpful. I don't know. I'm still learning and processing from the last couple of weeks.
I think this most recent struggle, this rent strike happening at Villas del Paseo, really have highlighted for us like the serious thirst for knowledge that tenants have, and people I think in general have, and trying to understand like what the hell is happening to them. How can we, who do we place the blame on? How do we make heads or tails of everything? You know, I think a very like simple example of this is in one of the WhatsApp chats we set up for tenants to communicate with each other that some of the HTU members are on. Tenants are sharing resources. They're trying, you know, to share news clips as well. And one of the tenants on there shared a resource of the Houston Apartment Association, which kind of masquerades itself as, you know, this middle of the road kind of benevolent organization that's there for tenants, but also is there for landlords. When in reality, it's a landlord lobby. And so we saw that, and we were just talking with tenants, and we're like, hey, this isn't a resource for you guys. They're actually a landlord lobby. You know, they pay these politicians to pass laws in Texas that kind of screw you guys over and kind of are responsible for the conditions that we find ourselves in. And it opens up these new conversations, and there's just a lot of curiosity out there on behalf of tenants to really, like I said, make sense of what they're going through and really break down and understand like power dynamics in the city. You know, why hasn't the city been keeping up with this complex? Why hasn't the city, you know, why doesn't the city know that all these valves are broken? There's like all these unresolved issues that keep getting worse year after year, you know, climate change crisis after climate change crisis. And so we are, you know, at the same time, just kind of doing on the ground political education with everyone. And it's been really dope. So I think, you know, the more things we have to offer people searching for solutions and understandings of these things that they're facing, like the better it is. And at the same time, I'd say like strategy and tactics have been another huge thing we've been discussing with tenants, right? What to do about the issues that they're facing. Now they jump to the rent strike on their own, right? And that's a huge first step. There's also so many things to consider once starting a rent strike that we have to start talking with tenants about. What kind of legal recourses do they have after starting a rent strike? You know, in Texas, once you don't pay rent, you lose a lot of legal recourse here. Because so much rides upon the lease contract. And once you break that, then you're pretty much screwed. And so what other things do we have at our disposal to really stop evictions? Right? What do we need to do? What do we need to have in place that when the landlords really get their shit together and when they come off the defensive and go on the offensive, what do we have in place to protect ourselves? You know, so it's really getting at these strategy and tactic conversations with them that I feel like the more you're prepared to do that, the more ideas and thoughts you have, the more you're able to take their ideas and thoughts and incorporate them as well, the better equipped you'll be to really have some, you know, just amazing organizing, some organizing that's like super powerful, and super dynamic. A lot of us have, you know, experience doing organizing for a while now. So for myself, my organizing goes back to 2013 in terms of housing with the Southwest Defense Network. Then the conditions were very different, as you can imagine. We had a few multi-tenant campaigns, but nothing in terms of the scope of organizing that we're seeing now. And so it's a huge learning curve to overcome. And the more experience you have, the more opportunities you have to organize and overcome some of these learning curves, that I think the more of an impact you'll have once crises hit, instead of like waiting for those moments and then getting active. Because what we're having to do now really is just build on the go with tenants. And it's amazing to behold. But at the same time, it's super challenging, and it's so easy to stumble and overlook something if, like, you know, you're not really on top of things. So I think experience, man, the more you get your hands dirty, the more you learn, I think the more equipped you'll be to really get out there and do some damage. Like I said, when these crises hit, part of the vision, at least for me with the Houston Tenants Union, is to really build independent, working class, like, activity, but also like institutions. Like, we need tenants, to, through their own struggle, you know, see how the state, can't address their most basic needs, and that the power relies in their ability to, like, take over and create new institutions that do fulfill their needs, that aren't based or don't duplicate or replicate capitalist social relationships, you know? And, you know, that does, to me, entail, like, taking over, housing, taking over all the things that we need to run our lives, to reproduce ourselves, you know? And I think for a lot of us, it's glaring. It's a problem that we see staring us like dead in the face, kind of like you've been laying out. And it's contradictory out there too with tenants. I think that they see it. They think they definitely see it, but there's still a sort of, I don't know what else to call it, but kind of like a social democratic tendency where there's an understanding that these institutions are still supposed to be there to serve us, even if they're not doing their damn jobs and haven't been for decades. There's still kind of that sort of consciousness there. And I think it starts to reach its limits. It starts to, that ideology starts to crack once the struggle really heightens, once people see like oppression or their movements repressed. You know, I think those, it becomes a little more clear. Right now, I think we aren't quite there in terms of this specific struggle, because people's tenants requests are all over the place. You know, some people want to be let out their lease and just move on. Some people want the complex to like fix the issues there. Some people want to get, you know, politicians involved. It's all over the place, man. And so I, like I said, I think it just goes back to, the need to really want, like, provide, you know, and help develop with tenants and other people struggling, like, their own understanding of the system, its limitations, and why these limitations exist. And then really start to come up through our organizing and develop alternatives, right? We need these alternatives. We need these other institutions that do what the state isn't doing.
Off that sludge pond and black through our sinks, heavy on the corn. planting the herb, you can't help but leave the sky. We can still flip you the bird. What will we do with no mountains to climb and you disappear and you shut down the mines? Pray God gives you mercy, the place you should dwell. You don't burn like coal and your sins to hell. Burn faster than you'd long these. Fill up them valleys, slurry them streams. Big old king, hold on, you lose in sleep.
This has been the It's Going Down podcast. Check itsgoingdown.org for daily updates, columns, action reports, and news. Go to itsgoingdown.org/shop to support us. And follow us on all social media platforms. IGD, your daily resource for insurgent proletarian life.